welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The definitions of the military have changed. The definition of war has changed. The definition of peace has changed. The role of the soldier has changed. Everything's changed. Today we're talking about that and why it matters. Georgetown University law professor and former Defense Department advisor Rosa Brooks has analyzed those changes and formed a prescription in her new book. It's entitled How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Rosa Brooks.
Thanks, Ann.
Give us a thumbnail of what you mean by this expanded role of the military, how it's everywhere.
It is everywhere. We have military personnel at this point in almost every country on Earth. There are only a handful of countries where there are no U.S. military personnel. And those service members are doing almost every job on Earth. We have military service members who are coming up with radio call-in shows for Afghan audiences. We have service members who are working on counter-piracy. We have service members who are trying to stop human trafficking in the Pacific. We have service members vaccinating cattle in Africa. So you name it, the military is now doing it.
You compare the military to Walmart. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, it's sort of become a one-stop shopping operation, and there's a story I tell in the book about my mother coming to visit me at the Pentagon when I was working there, and she comes and, you know, goes through the visitor entrance and all the security and comes up the escalator, and we walk past the food court, and we walk past the CVS drugstore and past the florists and the eye doctors and the chocolate store, and finally my mother just stops short in the corridor, and she looks around, and she says to me, "You're telling me that the heart of American military power is a shopping mall?" And I thought, you know, she's not totally wrong. The you know, there are 23,000 people who work in the Pentagon, and over time, you know, stores and restaurants have popped up to serve them, and the Pentagon itself, the military itself, has, you know, as in the post 9/11 era, as we expand what we think of as security threats, has been under a tremendous pressure to kind of offer a similar one-stop shopping experience to government policymakers, and it has done so. So now, you know, you say we need to prevent the root causes of terrorism by addressing government repression, or we want to prevent conflict that might be fueled by climate change. Whatever it is, the military's been asked to do it and has started to try to do it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the expanding role of the military. You just heard Rosa Brooks describe what she means by it. She's the author of a new book. It's entitled How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. If you have a question or comment for Rosa Brooks this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rosa, did all of this change come with 9/11? Or is it some of it associated as well with sort of the military-industrial complex predicted by President Eisenhower in 1961?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, 9/11 didn't change the world. It I think, made more apparent to Americans some changes that were occurring anyway, and really accelerated our changes in response. So I think it is several things. I mean, one is just that, and everybody knows this, in the era of globalization, rapid technological change, borders don't matter as much, states don't matter as much. Threats can now come from small organizations of non-state actors who cross borders of multiple nationalities, or even from individuals. You know, they can come from cyberspace, they can come from terrorist groups, et cetera. And that has been part of what has led to the military sort of playing catch up and trying to respond in a world in which threats could be anything and come from anywhere. You have to do everything, or there's a perceived need to do everything. But I also think that you're right. This, it becomes very much a self-fulfilling prophecy where you set up these bureaucracies, including defense contractors, all over the place, that are designed to respond to everything. And then you've got people whose jobs depend on doing everything. And you've got a lot of political constituencies that favor continual expansion.
What's the working definition of war at the Pentagon?
The Pentagon is not really that interested in defining war, in a sense. The Pentagon is more interested in thinking about conflict on a continuum. And I think that that's right from their perspective, right? That they're not focusing on it from a legal perspective. They're not interested in the categories that lawyers or political scientists like to use. From their perspective, their job is protecting the United States from threats. And those threats can take the form of a hostile state military. You know, you might think of Iran or North Korea or Russia. They can also take the form of threats from individual bad actors, and you know, one person, as we've seen, can launch an attack that kills 80 people, or a cyber attack that potentially is incredibly disruptive to critical infrastructure and could kill even more people indirectly. So from their perspective, I think war is less and less an interesting category. You know, it's more, their focus is much more on thinking about the full spectrum of operations across the spectrum of conflict. And there's an idea in modern American military doctrine of the sort of the spectrum of conflict, and they think of it as different phases. You know, that you have phases where you have what we would call peace. And the military calls it phase zero, you know, where nothing particularly bad is happening. And then you kind of move to higher level of threats and instability. And then you move to more assertive U.S. action to try to respond or deter. And then all the way at the other end of the spectrum, you know, you get what we think of traditionally as war, where you have, you know, massive numbers of troops, and people are dropping bombs and shooting at each other on a very large scale. But from the military perspective, partly because they're interested in prevention too. You're interested in all those phases in between as well.
All right. So then, who do they take their marching orders from, so to speak? You know, it used to be, and this is another issue, is that Congress had to declare war. If the military's not interested in that category as much anymore, then who are they taking their marching orders from?
You know, they continue to take their marching orders from the traditional civilian authorities. But I think what has happened is that traditional civilian authorities are number one, are less attuned to what's going on in those in-between spaces. You know, the spaces in between what we traditionally think of as war and what we traditionally think of as peace. And so a fair amount of stuff is going on. You know, it's not nefarious, in the sense that nobody's trying to hide it, but it's just kind of below the radar of a lot of members of Congress and even the White House. But there's also an extent to which this is very much being driven by demands coming from Congress, the White House, et cetera. You know, that if you are, and here's the other piece of that sort of vicious circle where we get sort of self-fulfilling cycles that I mentioned a minute ago. What happens is, you know, in the post 9/11 world, we collectively, including members of Congress and the White House, are looking at novel threats coming from novel quarters, you know, cyberspace, terrorism, epidemic disease, climate change. And we've been inclined since 9/11 to view those threats through the lens of war. We view them through the lens of war, then they all start seeming like military tasks. Therefore, the military has to expand what it does to try to address them, whether it's a problem that relates to governance or organized crime or Taliban activity or the Syrian war. And as the military expands what it does, you need higher military budgets, which means you have to look for savings elsewhere, which means that you cut or freeze civilian agency budgets, which means the civilian agencies can do less because they have less money, which means that elected officials turn to the military to pick up the slack, and that cycle just continues.
You also sort of described the military as an entity that's willing to, you know, people are willing to work ridiculous hours 24/7.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other way in which it's like Walmart. You know, yeah. Why do we go to Walmart? We don't go to Walmart because we think the quality of the goods it sells is so fantastic, or we get these rare, exotic items that can be found nowhere else. We know that we're going to Walmart basically because it's convenient and it's open late and it's big and you can get everything there and you don't have to make 16 different stops at 16 little stores. You know, we may not like Walmart, but we all end up there at some point or another because it's just too convenient. And if there's a story that a A friend of mine, retired Army Major General Paul Eaton, told me about being in Afghanistan and about 10 years ago, and he and other senior Army officials look around and they say, "Wow, you know, we can keep killing Taliban soldiers, but ultimately, unless the Afghans can reform their agricultural economy so it's not so dependent on opium poppies and drug sales, this place will never be stable." So they call up the Department of Agriculture back in Washington and they say, "Hi, you know, this is the Army. We're here in Afghanistan. Please send us some agriculture experts." And of course, the people at the Department of Agriculture say something along the lines of, "You know, there are only two of us and we're really busy and we don't really want to go to Afghanistan where there's a war, because why would we want to do that?" And so the Army officials say, "Well, okay, we really wish we could get civilian experts here, but hey, wait a second, there are all these farmers in the Army Reserves and the National Guard. Let's get them here." And 6 months later, you've got essentially a battalion of farmers in Afghanistan, and they may not be the right people. You know, they may not have quite the right expertise. Being a farmer from Iowa is not the same thing as being an expert on agricultural reform in Afghanistan, but the military can get them there. They can't say no. They can't say, "Oh, I don't feel like going to Afghanistan right now. I understand it's dangerous." You know, they're open 24/7, and they can mobilize. They can mobilize human talent on a scale that no other institution in our society can do.
There's a lot of mixed emotions about this, even in the military, right?
Yeah. Right. No, absolutely. I mean, and here again, I mean, I think the Walmart metaphor is imperfect, but
it's working for me right now.
Telling. Yeah. No, I mean, we hate Walmart. We don't want to see it. We want it to be outside of town with all the other ugly big box stores that we don't like and that we're too cool for. And we want to think of ourselves as being such original individual people that we don't like these sort of mass stores and their cheap, tacky stuff and, you know, they're ugly. So we exile them through zoning laws to the sort of outskirts of town. And the military is the same, right? That, you know, we exile it to isolated bases in the middle of nowhere with barbed wire and guard shacks between us and the military. But as with Walmart, you know, we end up sooner or later, we end up needing something that only they're the only institution that seems able to provide it, you know, at the scale and with the speed and on the scale that we want. And I think within the military, absolutely, there's a lot of ambivalence because, you know, a lot of people join the military with you know, World War II movies shaped their image of what they were going to do. And when they find themselves, you know, trying to create a microenterprise loan program for Afghan women or anti-trafficking campaign in the Philippines, they sort of think, "Wait a sec, I'm not trained to do this. I don't know how to do this. I don't necessarily want to do it. Like, I get that somebody should do it, but why is it me? Mm-hmm. Does this make it, you know?" So I don't think it's a situation that I think creates a lot of uneasiness, and the military is very acutely aware that they're not very good at most of these things because that's not the way the military is. It's not structured to recruit, train, and deploy experts on economic development or governance reform. It's structured to fight. And yet much of the time these days for most of the people in it, although we still do want the military to fight, increasingly for most of the people, most of the time we want them to do something radically different.
We're talking about the changing role of the military in the United States. My guest is Rosa Brooks. She's a law professor. She's an author, a journalist. Her latest book is entitled How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. talking about the evolution of the U.S. military. My guest is law professor, journalist, and former Defense Department advisor, Rosa Brooks. Her new book is entitled How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Rosa Brooks, in talking about this, a lot of the conversation feels sort of Orwellian. It's something I studied in social science, sociology classes, military sociology classes in college. You've acknowledged that, right?
Oh, Orwellian, I don't know. That makes it, we're not organized enough to be Orwellian in this country, right? And that maybe is a little scary. I think there's a line from
Well, that's Thomas, isn't Thomas that part Pynchon. Of it, though, that it happens without
yeah,
really thinking about
right.
it?
Well, I think there's a line from one of Thomas Pynchon's books where he says, the only thing more frightening than a conspiracy is discovering that it's not a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it is. I mean, it's happened very haphazardly. And I think that's part of the problem, you know, that because it's happened kind of slowly and in an ad hoc way, that most Americans don't quite realize how much has changed.
We have an email from Dakota, who acknowledges they're a former Georgetown colleague of yours, Rosa Brooks.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, Dakota.
Dakota's a law professor at OSU.
Dakota's on the email. All right. Yes, indeed.
Who asks, can't we trace this military mission creep in part to deep reductions in our diplomatic capabilities in the 1990s? The State Department and U.S. Agency for International Development were cut even more deeply than the military after the Cold War, and so policymakers started leaning on the military. Then 9/11 came along and put that dynamic on steroids, and that's certainly part of the message from your book.
Yes, no, and Dakota is absolutely right, and that's part of that vicious circle, you know, that the more you cut on the civilian side, the more you have to go to the military because it's the only institution left standing, and the more you go to the military, the more you think, well, we don't really need those civilian agencies anymore. They don't do anything anyway, so what's the point of funding them?
And they don't have the resources to fight for themselves in terms of fighting for those dollars.
No, I mean there's something people often say, and for years I thought that can't really be true, and I checked and it is true, and they say that there are more members of military marching bands than there are foreign service officers in the United States, and that is actually true. And the trouble is, you know, every member of Congress has military personnel or military bases or defense contractors in their constituency who they want to, you know, they want to move money in that direction. But nobody has a factory producing foreign service officers or economic development experts for USAID in their constituency. And so it's just all of the incentives push in the direction of funding defense-related stuff and not funding the civilian diplomacy and development activities.
I want to take a call now from Susie in Columbus because she gets at another point in your book. Susie, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thanks, Anne, for this great program, and Rosa, for your marvelous book. And I wanted to ask about a different angle, which is that even our local reports from Steve Brown at WOSU are starting to talk, at least, about so many police did this and so many civilians nearby, when the police are supposed to be civilians. And that seems really dangerous to me. So I wondered what you thought about that. And I have to add that, you know, you started with your mom's great insight. And I really admire her. If it's true that she's Barbara Ehrenreich,
she is Barbara Ehrenreich.
That's right.
You know, you are a marvelous family, but she really inspired, you know, all
kinds. Oh, well, that's great
to
hear. That will make her very happy.
And I know your brother does fabulous work too. So thank
you. Well, we were all put to work with little typewriters when we were a mere babe. So, no dinner until you've written 300 more.
That is just wonderful.
Well, Susie's point, I think, is a really interesting one, is sort of thinking about the ways in which the militarization of American foreign policy after 9/11 has been mirrored in some respects by sort of militarization of police cultures. And it's a really complicated issue because I don't think it's the causation is completely straightforward. But I think, yeah, it's interesting. Police have often, you know, for more than 15 years, thought of thought of non-police as the civilians in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way, but it is interesting how that language is kind of creeping into how journalists talk about it, too, because, of course, you're right. Police are civilians. They're not supposed to be. They're not members of the military. They're not supposed to think of themselves that way. They're supposed to be thinking of themselves as servants of the community who are part of communities as well. And it is telling to the extent to which the language is changing. I mean, I do think we've seen a couple of things since, some of which are directly the result of our post 9/11 conflicts, you know, one of which is just all this surplus military equipment, which has been made available, heavily subsidized through Homeland Security grants to municipal police. And everybody loves gear and everybody loves gadgets. So no police department is going to say, no, thank you. They're all going to say, cool stuff, you know, give it to me. But then the police start literally looking more like soldiers. We've also seen a dramatic expansion of the role of very paramilitary SWAT teams operating in police. And when SWAT teams were first created, the concept was that they were going to be for emergencies. They were going to be for hostage rescue, the occasional terrorist incident. But, you know, if you build it, they will come. And this is sort of related, Anne, to your earlier point about military-industrial complexes. You know, once you have them and you've got these highly trained guys, or mostly guys, you know, in a state of high readiness, you want to use them. And if you don't have a whole lot of hostage situations or terrorist situations, you start using them for other stuff. You start using them to serve high-risk warrants. You start using them in drug busts. And there, you know, there's some interesting work that's been done on the rising number of SWAT raids in many municipalities, partly because they're there. That being said, I think it's not as simple as just, aha, you know, bad military trends coming to a police department near you, because I think there are also some interesting ways in which the experience of the military in the last 15 years is actually fueling some more progressive ideas about community policing, too. You know, that part of the military experience in Iraq and Afghanistan was a shift from let's just go kill a bunch of people to wait a minute, we need to get legitimacy with the population and more of a counterinsurgency approach. You know, we need to build local institutions. We need to, you know, help establish credible forms of governance. We need to behave in ways that people see us as protectors, not as predators. And so you do have a lot of returning military personnel who end up joining police forces. It's a tried and true career path for many, many decades preceding 9/11. And bringing back with them actually some attitudes that sort of question the assumption of all the community members are enemies and instead say, wait, you know, if our job in Afghanistan and Iraq was to build ties with the community members and make them feel that we were here to protect them and help them, surely that's our job here in Chicago or here in Los Angeles or here in this small town that I'm in as well. So I think it's a complicated set of connections, and they don't all push in the same direction.
Does anyone benefit from an expanded military? Well, I mean, we talked earlier. I mean, not only are they coming back from the military and joining the police forces and the fire departments, but they're also joining military contractors.
That is absolutely true, and it certainly would be fair to say that military contractors are the most obvious beneficiaries of the expanding military. But I mean, I guess going back to that issue about the ways in which the relationship between military expansion and policing is not totally a simple one. You know, if you're an American who thinks, oh, gosh, you know, I wish the State Department AID and diplomacy and development were more important. Then you look at the last 15 years and you see it as the sort of glass half empty militarization of American foreign policy. And you say this is very bad. You could equally look at it if you're a glass half full kind of person, as in some ways the civilianization of the military, you know, that a real shift within the military from thinking our job is to go blow people up and blow stuff up to thinking, wait, maybe our job every now and then is to do that, but most of the time our job has to do with prevention, and prevention has to do with building strong governance institutions that are effective and can deliver services in a fair way to people, and our job is to help communities demand fair governance, and that pushes you in the direction of engaging in these kind of development and governance activities, which they may not do very well, but we might look at that and say, you know, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. You know, if the U.S. military is helping prevent malaria in Botswana or helping prevent human trafficking in the Philippines, that's if they can do it well, if they can change and do it well, maybe that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the changing role of the U.S. military. My guest is Rosa Brooks. She's author of a new book. It's entitled How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So beyond the issue of does anyone benefit from an expanded military then, Rosa, are we safer because of this?
That's a really good question. I think it's completely unanswerable because there's so many. This is not one thing, right? This is many, many, many different things. Do I think U.S. counterterrorism policy involving lethal force has made us safer? For instance, drone strikes, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. No, I don't think they've made us safer. I think, if anything, our world in many ways is more dangerous for us now, in part as a direct result of policy decisions that our government has made, both in the Bush administration and in the Obama administration. Do I think that some of these other kinds of longer-term activities that have to do with things like, you know, the cattle vaccination program or anti-malaria or anti-trafficking are making us safer? In the long run, I think they have the potential to make us safer. You know, and there are a lot of ifs in there, too. You know, if we do them well, you know, if we do them in sustainable ways, if we do them in ways that aren't obnoxious. But you know, again, leaving aside the sort of institutional consequences for other parts of the U.S. government, and there are lots of things I do worry about that have to do with a whole different cluster of issues relating to secrecy and the rule of law and democratic accountability for what's going on. But in terms of are we safer, some of these activities probably make us safer. Some of them push in the other direction.
Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Ed.
Hello. Yes. My question goes back to when you were talking about the separation of the military from the public by moving the bases farther and farther out. And over the last several rounds of the base reduction legislation and what I've seen lately, it seems like we're not only moving them farther and farther out, we're also clustering them into areas of the country that seem to be, the only way I can characterize it is more favorable to the military. We're moving them from the Midwest and the Northeast to the South and the Southwest.
Yeah.
And closing more and more bases in this area. And I'd like your comments on that as it portends to our future, and I'll listen off the air.
All right, Ed. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, it's a good question. Definitely, we have seen a shift, not just in the last 15 years, but, you know, really going back over the last 50, of consolidating bases, closing bases in the Northeast, for instance, and expanding them in the South and the Southwest. I think, though, here again, you know, the causation runs in a different direction. You know, it's not so much, oh, let's put military bases in conservative places that we perceive as military friendly. I think that what happens is when you put bases in particular places, and you then have large numbers of people in the population who are either part of the military or their employment prospects depend on those bases, that those communities become pro-military, right? People are more likely to join the military if they're the children of people who work on a base or they live near a base, et cetera. So again, you know, it's not a conspiracy. Part of the reason this happens is because it's really expensive to get a lot of space in New York. It's a whole lot cheaper to get a lot of space in the middle of the desert in Texas. You know, part of it is a legacy of the Army's growth of, you know, fighting Indian wars in the 19th century, that, you know, big bases sort of pushing out further west and further southwest. You know, so it's driven more by economic reasons, that if you're looking for a lot of space where you're not going to have a lot of neighbors complaining about the noise from firing ranges or from military planes flying overhead, you want to put your bases where there's a lot of empty space, and that is not the northeastern corridor of the United States. But it does, again, you know, it's yet another thing that then becomes self-fulfilling, because you know, we know about what's near us, and our children do what they see people around them doing. And mm-hmm. so if you live in New York City, you don't see a lot of military personnel and you don't know a lot of military personnel. You know, if you live in Fort Carson, near Fort Carson, Colorado, or you live near Fort Bliss in Texas, or you live near Fort Bragg in North Carolina, you know, or any other big base, you know, you're going to, it's going to be more familiar. You're going to think, hey, this is a good thing. You're going to think, hey, I've met a lot of people I like. Maybe I'll consider that as my own career path, and it becomes self-fulfilling.
You make the point that ordinary Americans revere the military more than ever, but understand it less than ever. And I want to talk about that paradox in more detail, but is that part of this? I mean, is this clustering and the isolation from most of us part of why we don't understand it?
Yeah, I do think that's a big part of it. And, you know, we went after Vietnam. We have an all-volunteer military. And obviously, most of us think that that's a good thing. Most Americans would not want a military draft. But one of the things that having an all-volunteer military does is it means fewer and fewer Americans have skin in the game, if you will. You don't have to care about the military. There's no danger that if you're not interested in the military, there's no danger that you're going to be forced to be part of it against your will and sent off to a dangerous place to do things you don't want to do. So you don't have to think about it. But I think there's sort of the cultural hangover after Vietnam was a slightly guilty sense of, gee, maybe the anti-war culture kind of blamed the troops for policy decisions that were not theirs, and that wasn't fair. And so we're not part of the military. I don't know anything about it. I don't really want to know anything about it, but I want to show that I'm supportive, you know. And so we've developed a culture, particularly since 9/11, obviously, where it's almost a sort of civil religion in this country to, you know, I support the troops. They're all heroes. And I don't think that's a particularly good thing. I mean, it's good to be interested and respectful of a large public institution that acts at the behest of those we elect and thus ultimately on our behalf. It's not good, though, to be simultaneously ignorant and adulatory, because what that ends up meaning is that you don't ask the questions you should ask.
We're talking about the changing role of the military in the U.S. My guest is Rosa Brooks. She's the author of a new book entitled How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If we are at war, all sorts of things are possible. Guantanamo, wiretapping, all sorts of infringements on privacy. What does that mean when war never ends? We're talking about the U.S. military and how its role in American society has changed over time. Still with us is law professor, journalist, and author Rosa Brooks. Her new book is entitled How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Rosa Brooks, you're married to either a current military person or a former military person.
Hey, just retired.
Okay. Wasn't sure. So
yes,
you know about what you speak. I mean, you've experienced the whole thing of when you say, you know, I'm married to someone in the military, people revere you as well.
Yeah, there's this funny experience. I mean, so we've been married for about 5 years. I have been a journalist and writing and talking about these issues for much longer than that. And, you know, a funny thing happened when I married an Army officer. People who didn't used to listen to me suddenly start nodding and saying, oh, you are so right. You know, and I think that goes back to what we were talking about a couple of minutes ago, which is the sort of civil religion in this country of mm-hmm. we support the troops. The military is the one public institution that in polls people say they trust, they have confidence in it. Congress it won't surprise you to hear, is way down at the bottom. Nobody likes it. So there's this. You know, you say I'm a military spouse, and everybody gets all sort of respectful and silent and worshipful, which of course can be nice. Everybody loves to be.
And they say you're a journalist, and
right, exactly. Then they get really confused if you're both, right? But it's unearned, obviously. I mean, being a military spouse, being a service member, doesn't necessarily mean that you know anything about anything. It means you're part of a particular community. You may know about certain things, but it doesn't make you a foreign policy expert. It doesn't make you a domestic policy expert necessarily. You know, there are people who are those things in the military community. There are people who are not, just as in the civilian community. So I feel very ambivalent when I get that reaction from people, because I think, you know, on the one hand, well, I'm glad that this makes you feel more inclined to listen, but I'm not sure that should be the thing that makes you feel more inclined to listen.
Kevin in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Nice talk. Enjoying listening to Rosa, although I probably would take a little bit of exception to her earlier comments about because reductions in the State Department and civilian agencies creating the problem. When I was over in Iraq, I was there as a JAG officer. I was originally a line officer, then went to JAG later. But
JAG being an attorney, right?
Right, the judge advocate corps.
Yep.
With my experience, of course, it might be anecdotal, was we were having to fill slots because State Department civilian employees wouldn't want to come for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And so that's why we were being dragged in. We weren't seeing it from the standpoint of, oh, they're suffering reductions of personnel. They just flat out didn't want to come.
Well, no, that's what she said.
I think it's both. But I think you're right. It's partly, you know, in the early part of the conversation, we talked about, you know, the military is like Walmart. It's open 24/7. It's got employees who will go anywhere and do anything. And you can't order a State Department official to go to war. That's absolutely right.
And again, I was basically thrust into a mission of trying to teach setting up basic contracts or basic subsistence and supplies to the reconstituted Iraqi army.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I did a Walmart type job. I like to think of it at Macy's level, but.
Right, or Nordstrom or.
Yeah, right.
Again, wasn't trained for that. It was frustrating given the language difference, but, you know, I was basically trying to learn kind of a fundamental understanding of federal procurement law and at least stripping away the more complicated parts and trying to help them understand how to put that together, because quite frankly, they grew up and operated in a culture. You went to the local Baptist party chief and he basically told you who the contracts were going to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just were fundamentally unequipped to deal with what we would take for granted.
Yeah.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate your time. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You've noted that the search for endorsements from generals, admirals, veterans, and their families wasn't always routine. And when did this become a thing? I mean, is it my imagination or has it just been totally ramped up this year?
It's been ramped up. I mean, it's always been a thing. You know, we've had former military officials run for office, of course, become president. There's nothing totally new about retired military officials becoming involved in partisan politics, and nor is it necessarily a bad thing. Right? They're American citizens, like all the rest of us. There's, you know, they have opinions about policy, and some people become truly expert. But it does seem to be the case, and there have been a couple of recent studies done that back this up, that the sort of number of endorsements in partisan political races by recently retired senior officers has gone up dramatically. And, you know, you saw it almost to the point of absurdity in the Clinton-Trump exchange just a couple weeks ago, when there was that commander-in-chief forum where Donald Trump was literally standing there waving a piece of paper saying, you know, I have 88 generals who signed this piece of paper endorsing me. And within an hour, the Clinton campaign said, well, we have, you know, 93.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little silly. And that, you know, again, I mean, it, just as people shouldn't listen to me more because I'm married to an Army officer, they should, I hope, listen to me based on whether or not I'm making any sense to them. You know, the fact that you got 88 or 93 guys who used to wear a uniform who say they're going to vote for you really shouldn't have any impact on your vote or mine. You know, we should be making our own decisions. And there's, you know, military personnel, even senior officers, do not have some mystical ability to determine what set of policies is going to make sense for the nation.
Dan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Hi. My question revolves around the huge amounts of money that we spend for the military, and I have now understand a little bit more about where some of this money is going, but still, when there are billions in audits that aren't accounted for and billions more going to defense projects of contractors that were brought up earlier, and then that never fly, or similar, you know a lot more about it than I do. Are we getting our money's worth as taxpayers?
The problem is it's impossible to know, and it's impossible to know partly for the reasons that you mentioned, that the Defense Department is just so vast that it's hard for it to even keep track of everything. You know, when you get spending on that scale. Just the challenges of trying to track and account for everything get multiplied. But it's also hard to know for a reason we haven't talked about much yet, which is that particularly post 9/11, you know, huge swathe of military activities and other government activities as well have kind of disappeared into the classified universe. You know, that so much of our counterterrorism-related efforts, including things that you wouldn't necessarily be thinking about, some of the things that get at those more non-traditional, broader kinds of activity, are highly classified. And so the general public has no ability to find out, well, exactly what programs are we operating and how do we know if they're working? And even for members of Congress, and indeed even for senior executive branch officials who are charged with oversight, the way it often works in practice, and I've seen this many times, is that you know, you, because the material is classified, people aren't even necessarily sent information on programs or outcomes electronically. It's brought by in a folder by a courier. They have a very short time to look at it. Members of Congress often find that they're not legally permitted to discuss it with their staff, who tend to be the substance experts, because their staff may not have the requisite clearance for certain kinds of highly sensitive programs. So you've got, you know, a short period of time to look at something you can't take home with you and study more seriously. You can't ask your staff what they think about it and do more research. And you're being told, this is really important, authorize its continuation. And you don't want to be the guy or the woman who says no, because you don't feel like you understand it enough. And so we get some very expensive classified programs that, for the worst possible reasons, end up continuing in perpetuity because nobody knows enough about them to be willing to be the one to pull the plug.
Right, and everybody's afraid to be the one to pull the plug,
right,
because it makes
precisely.
Them look bad, like they're anti-military.
Precisely. And you know, again, the problem of classification over classification is not a new one. You know, every decade or so, there's some blue ribbon congressional commission that says, oh, this is terrible, we should stop, and nothing ever really happens. But it is a bigger and bigger problem as more and more chunks of the federal government kind of vanish into the world of highly sensitive classified programs.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dan. And Kenneth in Northwest Ohio. Welcome, Kenneth.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Civil religion, indeed. Thanks for taking my call. I was in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, served in the infantry, so I've seen what this country does in war fairly up close and personal. I can't wait to read the book. My initial question, comment was, General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, it's much talked about the coalition. The military-industrial complex, I saw a redacted version of that decades ago. It was, I believe, John Foster Dulles that talked President Eisenhower into deleting a word, and it originally read the military-industrial-congressional complex.
Mm, yeah.
Talked about bases in Texas. She talked about skin in the game. I mean, President Frank Roosevelt's son was a Marine Raider during the Second World War. It is indeed a civil religion. It is ultimately patriotism light. To say it needs to be done, but I don't want to do it, to say it needs to be done, and ISIS does need to be dealt with, in my opinion, to say that I don't want my son to be involved in it, that is the lowest form of cowardice.
Kenneth, thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks. Yeah, you know,
make an argument, Rosa Brooks, that mm-hmm. we do need to be more involved.
Well, I think we need to be involved because this is our future, you know, that all those civilians who think to themselves, you know, oh, thank goodness there's no draft. Thank goodness I don't have to go be in the military. Thank goodness my children don't have to go be in the military. You know, it's a sort of a short-term kind of safety because all these decisions that are being made in terms of what the military does and what our counterterrorism policies are, what gets done in secret, what's done out in the open, you know, these are decisions that do affect us. They may not affect us next year in a visible way, but everybody will pay if there are bad decisions sooner or later. You know, and I mean, you asked earlier, are we safer? And I said that I think on the counterterrorism realm, in many ways, I think we're less safe, partly as a result of bad decisions for the last 15 years. You know, and we will all pay for this. We are paying for them. The fact that there are places in the world that American tourists can no longer go with any degree of safety, the fact that, you know, we are likely to be experiencing that reality for many decades to come, you know, there are going to be costs to us all, and we're kidding ourselves if we think that's not true.
In an op-ed for the LA Times, you wrote that the military can't be placed outside the realm of politics, not, that is, if we wish to retain the ability to debate the questions most essential to a democracy. So those being, what wars should we fight, why and how and at what cost, and why is that, you know, and I'm wondering, you know, we haven't debated much about any of this for a long time now.
No, that's right. And I think that the very shallow kind of civic religion of we support the troops, you know, not only is it quite shallow in general, but it actually operates to prevent any kind of meaningful debate because Americans don't want to be seen as not supportive of the military, meaning the humans in it, the troops. That often people are very reluctant to ask hard questions about policy and budgets and so forth. We think, oh, well, I don't want to look like I'm undermining the troops and you know, I've got to say yes, yes, rah, rah, no matter what the decisions about how to use those troops happen to be. And I think that's a, you know, it's a terrible thing. It's impoverishing the American political discourse. I think that, you know, if you're going to be a critic, you need to be an informed critic. Just kind of sort of sniping and saying, oh, I don't like it, I don't like it, I don't like it, is also no good. But I think that both as a matter of civic duty and as a matter of, frankly, long-term sheer national self-preservation, American citizens can't afford to maintain that level of sort of, you know, happy ignorance.
And you suggest that even if it's not necessarily warfare that you're invested in, some kind of service?
Well, I would love to see a real universal mandatory national service in this country, which wouldn't be solely military, which would have, you know, options that include Peace Corps-like activities and AmeriCorps and VISTA-like activities. But I do think that both from the perspective of fixing some of our much-needed infrastructure and serving some communities who are currently very underserved, but also from the perspective of you know, helping to do what the draft did do in the World War II era, which was forge a stronger sense of national identity, a stronger sense of shared commitment to collective national projects, I think would be incredibly powerful. It would be in the short term expensive, but I think in the long term as an investment in building America, both from a civic perspective and from a literal infrastructure perspective, would be incredibly worthwhile in the long run.
Rosa Brooks, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate all your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Rosa Brooks, her new book is entitled How Everything Became War. How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.